Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, maintaining an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business, in Connecticut, Rhode Island, Reston, Virginia, and Greater Boston. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik, and we told you the other day that we were giving the first in a two-part series on video streaming services. The first, of course, was with Mark Randolph, who was one of the co-founders of Netflix. If you didn't get to listen to that, go back and make certain that you do. It's not a prerequisite to listen to the one we're providing today, John.
No.
But it really helps to get that.
And plus, everybody on their planet, I think, during COVID has watched Tiger King.
Netflix has done extremely well, though I saw where their stock was going down. But, you know, it's really such a competitive field today. You talked about that in the introduction to our last podcast. But let's get a lay of the land from a guy who follows this day in and day out. His name is Dan Rayburn, and he is considered to be one of the foremost authority speakers, writers on streaming media technology, content, and business models. And we really like to bring you into the innards of where various industries are headed in our country. And this guy is wonderful. He always presents at the NAB, which is the National Association of Broadcasters. He's a principal analyst for Frost and Sullivan. This guy knows what he's talking about, John. So we really delve. So we told you about how Netflix started. Now we're going to tell you what the industry looks like today. Yeah, and where it's going. Because, well, that's what we do.
Interesting.
Absolutely. On America Trends, more about video streaming today.
With me on the line on America Trends is Dan Rayburn, considered to be one of the foremost authorities, speakers, and writers on streaming media technology, and he's a principal analyst for Frost and Sullivan. Dan, this whole area of streaming, not just because of the coronavirus and the fact that we're all indoors, but it has been growing by leaps and bounds with new services and new audiences. I mean, how remarkable is this particular industry, given the backdrop of the success over the years of broadcast networks and cable networks?
Yeah, it's a great question, and thanks for having me today. Appreciate it. You know, I love talking about streaming media technology and the business model. And what some people don't know is 2020 marks the 25th year that streaming media technology has been in existence. And that's an amazing amount of time. A lot of people, because of what's going on with the virus right now, are thinking, wow, streaming is really getting its, you know, in the spotlight here, and it's really getting its day in the sun. And it's like, no, it's been around a long time. And, you know, the best way to sort of show that is just think about the older generation, someone like my mom now, right, who can just be given a Roku and just set it up herself, and next thing you know, she's watching your shows, right? She doesn't need to know the technology behind it, and that's the whole point. That's when you know that a technology has had success, when people aren't thinking about the technology. They're thinking about the business models. They're thinking about the content. They're thinking about consuming videos, and they're not thinking about bits and bytes of how it gets to them. So it's an amazing time for streaming now, because the services in the market are simply making it easier for consumers to watch more content more often at higher quality for longer periods of time on more devices. So that's exactly what we want as an industry, but it's taken a long time to get there.
When did the broadband technology improve to the point that it was quite practical to stream without all the buffering and all the limitations?
Yeah, great question. So it was really about 2000 when we started seeing video encoded at a higher quality, to where it actually started to, I'll say, somewhat look good. back then, you had some people with ISDN lines. For those of you that remember those days, we were past the dial-up, but we had ISDN lines. Some companies started getting T1. So that was around 2000, sort of still when the before the bubble burst in 2002. But it was really about, I would say, 2006 and 2007 is when broadband became ubiquitous enough in the U.S. in enough major cities, obviously not in rural areas, but still in major cities, to where it really started to look good. And we started to see video encoded around 2 megs per second. And some people on the phone are probably like, I don't know what the hell 2 megs is, right? But to give you an idea, today Netflix's average video is encoded around 6. The compression has gotten a lot better in terms of being from years ago, from being able to push fewer bits through the broadband connection to the end user, but still giving them a really great quality. So I would say it's been about 12 years, 13 years that it's been very good quality. And the way I judge that, when you say the word quality, everybody judges that differently. There's methodology that's different. It's kind of like saying to someone, what's the best car to buy? Well, there's no right or wrong answer. It's a matter of how do you judge quality for what you need. So with video, the way we see consumers judging that is it easy to use? Does it start up real quickly? And does it buffer in the middle? And what you've seen over the last really 7-8 years is video services that are very consistent, very easy to use, and pretty much always work. So just think about, when was the last time you heard somebody you know complain that, man, Netflix's video doesn't look good? Never.
Yeah, you don't, right? You don't hear that any longer. And I've got to ask, as somebody who's come out of broadcast network television, what has the effect been? Because honestly, I don't watch NBC, CBS, ABC any longer. I just don't. I don't know what it is. I don't know why my predilection has all moved to, you know, Netflix and Amazon Prime and so many others that are coming online. I know it just started as a distribution platform for reruns and original, well, movies that came from different production studios. When did it really morph into a production and creative shop?
Well, it has been for quite some time, really 10 years ago. So when Netflix came to the market and started putting all this money into the market by buying content and licensing content, that really changed a lot of dynamics around the traditional way that movies and TV shows were packaged and the way that content was licensed. Because keep in mind, Netflix first came into the market and said to companies, we will license a lot of your back catalog of content that you're not really distributing anywhere right now and nobody's watching. So Netflix's first approach to the market was breadth and depth of catalog. At one point, if you remember in the beginning when they started streaming, Netflix would actually tell you how many total titles they had available. It used to be something like, you know, we now have 40,000 titles and TV shows and movies available for streaming. Because back then, consumers wanted breadth and depth. Many years later, Netflix realized it wasn't the depth of the catalog you had, it was the quality. And we have this saying in the industry, content is king. So they quickly realized it wasn't about how many titles were available. People were getting lost with choice. It was the type of content that was available, hence why Netflix got into original production and realized we could produce a lot of our own content that'll keep our viewers, but doesn't require us to have to license so much legacy content. So I'd say about 10 years ago, it really started to change the market. And today, it certainly does have an impact on the traditional broadcast networks and the cable companies and MSOs, the MVPDs. But keep in mind, too, that it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison, because for the last 7 years, my industry has run around saying, oh, everyone's just going to cut the cord, get rid of cable TV, and they'll do everything streaming. That sounds like a good idea, but the problem is people still like live TV. They like it for the Emmys. They like it for, of course, sports. Sports is the biggest driver. They like it for news. And today, if you want to cut the cord but still get live TV, you go with Hulu, which has a live service. You go with Sling TV. You go AT&T TV. You know, there's services out there that allow you to get live. The problem is most of them are more expensive than cable, YouTube TV. They've all raised their rates over the last 2 years multiple times because the cost for them to license live content is so high. And then we also saw PlayStation View, which was run by Sony, closed up shop beginning this year because they simply said the cost to license is so high and we can't charge consumers enough to ever cover the cost. So many of those services start at $55 a month for live TV. So while we have seen an impact in the industry, no doubt in terms of cord cutting, it has not been at the rate that many analysts and members of the media have predicted for the last couple of years.
But so many people, Dan, say, there's so much content, I don't know what to watch. And we used to be a nation that watched a whole lot of things together. It was a communal thing. The last episode of MASH or All in the Family or whatever it may be. Today, we're all watching our own streaming services, some in combination with original cable. I might like FX or somebody might like TNT or whatever. I'm just wondering, though, the economics of this, having been in this business, how do they monetize all this content? Now I know that the models are changing where it's not all in syndication because a lot of these streaming services are tying up some of these showrunners and some of these creative people. But it just seems there's such an enormous wealth of dramatic work, and we know how expensive a drama is to mount.
Agreed, agreed. So one of the, I'll call it sort of the dirty little secrets in our industry, is that nobody likes to talk about the real metrics that should be used to judge success in monetization. So you hear a lot of people running around, a lot of these companies running around going, you know, video views were up 30% last quarter. Okay, but did you deliver 30% more ads? No. Did you get 30% more subscriptions? No. So a lot of these services struggle to become profitable. We've seen some actually go under. We've seen other companies get acquired by larger conglomerates. The interesting thing now, if you look at who's really in the market, they're owned by super big companies where their primary business is not streaming. So, for instance, you know, Peacock, right? That's just released
today. Right,
that's
coming out with Comcast and NBC Universal.
Right. Today on Comcast, it came out for subscribers, but it's owned by a larger company. If you look at something like Sling TV, who's it owned by? It's Dish Network. Right. If you look at Prime Video, who's it owned by? Amazon. So you have these companies that are much, much larger. You know, HBO Max will come out later this year. It's owned by what? AT&T, a wireless company. That's where they make most of their money. So the business model for all of these companies is really different. Even though everyone throws Netflix, Amazon, Hulu, Disney all together, if you think about it, what is Netflix own? No hardware, no commerce. They have a streaming service. That's all they do. If you look at someone like Apple, well, they own hardware, ecosystem, browser, store, right? They have a different reason why they're doing video. Then look at Amazon, commerce. They own hardware with the Fire TV device, the Cube. They own tablets. They have a different business model. Then look at Disney. Disney has a three-pronged approach because it owns 80%+ of Hulu. It owns ESPN Plus, and it owns Disney Plus. Three different services bundled together. But Disney gets the majority of the revenue from where? Not from streaming, from theme parks, from cruises, from movies, from toys. That's a different business model. And then AT&T.
Yes, but now let's take Disney, for example, where there may be a real downturn as it relates to what it is they can look for in terms of live events for a while. And now they put up Disney Plus. It went to 50 million subscribers already worldwide. They were expecting that it would take until the end of 2024 to get up to 60 or 80 million. So now they're looking at this perhaps differently, but now this streaming service is much more valuable.
Well, yes and no. So it's not that it's much more valuable. They always knew the value in this. And the way to prove that point is before the service be launched, the same we saw with AT&T, and same we saw with Peacock, is they held an investor relations days because they're spending billions of dollars to launch these services. But before they even launch, they want to outline for investors, we know we're spending a lot of money, but here's our plan to make it back. Here's how quickly we're going to make the money back. And, you know, give us a little bit of breathing room because we know we're spending billions of dollars on this. So Disney always felt that Disney Plus was one of the three-legged approach of, you know, it's one tier of if you like family content, Disney Plus is great for you. You like sports, you have ESPN Plus, you want back catalog of content and live TV, Hulu. They have a really nice bundle there. The estimates that Disney put out, keep in mind too, nobody in the industry who tracks this ever believed Disney's estimates. They purposely lowballed that. Right? You're not going to come out and go, hey, we're going to get $50 million the first year, because then if you don't, it looks bad. So what do? You go, well, we think we'll get $60 to $90 million 4 years from now. We knew they were going to blow past that super fast because you have a great service at a really cheap price, and you went international in March and April. So the $50 million number doesn't really surprise anyone who tracks the market. To your point, yes, it certainly does benefit them at a time when nobody knew 4 months ago we were going to be in the condition we're in right now from a business standpoint. So it definitely helps that Disney has revenue coming in from a digital property at a time when physical locations, to your point, aren't generating any revenue. But keep in mind that's also temporary, right? That's not going to last forever. I keep saying to people, facts or fear. But yeah, Disney Plus is certainly very, very important to Disney.
By the way, it's really interesting, Dan. I'm sure you followed this, and I'm just going to make it an aside and then move on, that Bob Iger, who said he was retiring, a legendary leader of Disney, and now he's been the executive chairman, and he's now staying put for a while to help them through this really difficult transition. Let me go to the point that a lot of people raise, and then I want to get into some of the functionality of these streaming services for those of us who just love to watch a lot of the content on it. And that is, some people will say, well, wait a minute. I mean, we still have all the broadcasts. We still have all this cable. Now we've got these streaming services. There's only so many eyeballs, and there's only so much money out there to spend on media. I know, yeah. I'm buying now satellite radio, which I never thought I would spend $20 a month buying, but I am, because I like it. But, I mean, I can't listen to 500 channels that they offer me. I mean, when does this reach a saturation point?
It already has. It's a great question. So one of the things we're always debating in the industry is what we call the fragmentation. So as consumers, don't we love having choice? Most do. Well, most want choices of everything, food, clothing, cars, whatever you're buying, whatever you're consuming.
Yeah,
you
but
want
we only have two political parties.
Well, that's politics. That's a whole separate conversation, right? But a lot of choice also brings complexity and fragmentation. It brings confusion. So while certain services are not technically competing with one another because they're live sports and this is on-demand movies, everything is competing for our time. And that's the point you're making, is we all have a certain amount of time in the day that we can read news, watch short-form content on Instagram, Facebook, catch up with friends, family, whatever it may be, watch movies, watch TV shows, watch live sports, watch live news. We all can only consume so much content in the day. So what we're finding now is consumers are saying, man, I am really overwhelmed. There are now, in the U.S., there's over 300 OTT services to pick from. Some are very niche. Some are more broad. Around the world, there's more than 1,200. And which ones do you pick? And to your second point, how much money do I really want to spend every month? That's something else that consumers have to look at. So there is no right or wrong answer. One thing I really hate seeing in the market is someone in the media will write a story and saying, you know, if you're looking for content, this is the service you should pick, right? And it's like, well, you can't say that to your reader because, you know, they might have a family of kids and want that type of content, and another family doesn't. Or they like live sports and this one doesn't. So we have different viewing habits as individuals. We like different types of content. However, no matter what type of content we like, the amount of choices out there are just – it's getting pretty overwhelming. And this year, you just had Quibi launch this past week.
Yeah, now we can talk about Quibi. Mobile. I mean, this is that short-form notion that Katzenberg has put together. And a lot of people saying this is going to be fantastic. Others saying, no, not so much. I mean, again, this is a late entry given all that's come before. How different is this notion of Quibi?
Well, you have to ask, is it a late entry considering HBO – Max doesn't launch until May, and Peacock doesn't come out to everybody until July unless they move that up. So I wouldn't necessarily say it's late. Now, Quibi is an interesting one because, quite frankly, they're trying to do something that nobody else is doing, which is make the service available for mobile only. Now that it's launched and it's been out for 4 days, they're getting so much feedback saying this is sort of not the service I expected because I can't even watch it on my iPad and I can't cast it to a larger screen. So if I'm in the house like I am now during the quarantine, why would I ever watch it on this tiny little screen? So now they're saying that they're going to bump up the development of the ability to put it to a larger screen. How they're going to do that, we're not sure. Is that AirPlay functionality? Is it actually designing an app for streaming boxes? We don't know. Quibi is one that most people who track the industry have been saying, I don't get it. I don't see how this is successful. It's asking for the changing of consumer behavior in the U.S. of how we watch content on mobile. And the economics simply don't work. You know, at times, Quibi has said they're paying $20,000 per minute to produce a show. At those kinds of costs, you can't be charging $5 or $6 a month and expect you're going to be able to become profitable. So,
Dan, I don't even want to spend more time on Quibi, only because most people don't have it, don't know what we're talking about. But it is a different approach to streaming. But you brought up an interesting point. I watch a lot of my streaming on my iPad. I got a new iPad, and I love it. I love that intimacy. I love, you know, kind of just resting on the bed and putting it up on a pillow. But where do most people, or do we know, where they're watching most of this stream content?
It's a combination, right? There's no right or wrong. It depends on, is it short form, long form? Is it sports, not sports? Are you watching it with others on a large screen? So,
right.
It's on iPads and phones. It's on TVs. Now, inside the house, the TV, the largest screen, is still what's dominating the largest percentage of total viewing hours.
That
we know that
sense.
If we look at what some of the services put out, they'll tell us which device it's being watched on.
The friends and family notion, where everybody's sharing their subscriptions, it makes sense, obviously. I mean, it's really appealing, and you give it to your kids, your password. But, I mean, it seems as if they're really giving you a lot of content for a relatively small amount of money when you're sharing it among four or five families.
Yes, I would agree with that. And some of them have different rules in terms of what you can share and how you can share. But, yes, if that's the type of content that you like, that's definitely the case. But keep in mind, all these services also have a limitation on the number of simultaneous streams that can be consumed at a given time. So, for instance, Netflix, it's four if you take their highest tier. So even if you have eight people in your family, only four can watch it at any given time.
Let's talk about Netflix, because Netflix was, I guess, the granddaddy of a lot of this. And Netflix is kind of alone. It's out there. It's not part of Warner or AT&T or whatever service, Disney. How has it done all of this on its own? And is it the most, the one that's usually followed? I was reading where their business model is now being followed by the others. They're buying up these showrunners. They're paying them up front. They're not paying them, you know, back-end royalties. That they've really set the tone for the industry. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, to a degree they have for what they do. You know, Netflix was the first mover in the market. Netflix didn't invent streaming media technology. And they simply used it based on the right time in the market, with realizing that there was a need to deliver content digitally. Broadband was now just at the point of where you could do it. Some streaming media devices were starting to come out to make it easier. You didn't really have the iPad out as of yet. Smart TVs didn't exist when Netflix started. But Netflix definitely gets a lot of the credit for taking technology that had been around a long time and making it simple and easy to use for consumers, no doubt. They've also had to adapt their business model, obviously, of course, over the last 10-plus years that they've been streaming, like any business does. So a lot of people look at Netflix when they're launching services as, we call them, the gold standard, in the sense that from a reliability standpoint, from an ease of use standpoint, and from a quality standpoint, it just works. So when you're thinking about rolling out a consumer service in the market, many companies will want to argue about technology or who's got the latest or greatest or whatnot. But what you have to realize is the best technology is not what's always adopted. And one of the first things that's adopted by consumers is something that's easy. And that was the key thing, is Netflix made this easy, and it worked, and it wasn't going down every other day. It was a reliable service, and over time, they increased the quality as the technology got better, as broadband got better. And the other thing is, and this is very, very important, anybody can roll out a streaming service. It's not that complicated. However, to roll it out to where you have tens of millions, or in Netflix cases now 160 million subscribers worldwide, plus, that is the challenge, to roll out these services at scale. And that is where Netflix has just led the market really forever, because you can roll out a service to 10 subscribers and make it look really good, but try rolling it out to tens of millions or hundreds of millions and not having it break. Very, very difficult.
Well, not only about breakage.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
By the way, this is Dan Rayburn, principal analyst for Frost & Sullivan, recognized for his understanding, expertise, and he communicates it throughout the world about streaming. I mean, when I think about it, they know me so well, I think. They tell me that this is a 98% match for something that I've proven that I like. Now they're doing these ratings. This is number one. I just finished Ozark, which I loved. And, you know, that's number two after Joe Exotic. I mean, first of all, how true are these ratings? How well do they know us? And give us a sense of how smart these services are about who we are to keep us. Because I know that they will tell you, or they'll keep pushing you, if they can see that you're not using their service a lot. I have that with a drum community that I'm on. If I'm not going on every other day, they send me a note, hey, Larry, what's going on with you? So how well do they know me?
Well, it's a great question. So you really asked me two different things here. One is churn and retention of keeping you, but the second is personalization and recommendation. Mm-hmm. So all these services are working on always increasing their recommendation engines, which is a lot of data they're collecting in real time on the back end of what you're watching, when you're watching it, the device you're watching it on, so that once you're done or once you come back, they can make a recommendation that hopefully is something that you want to watch. Some recommendation engines are better than others. All these companies like to call it personalization. They're trying to personalize your experience. Many of them are not actually personalizing it. They're really just looking at, okay, what other content is popular? Okay, you watched this. Other people watched the following movie like you did, so we're just going to recommend that. To me, I don't really think of that as personalization. They're going with the laws of numbers there. Nothing against that, but they have to make the true personalization better. Second point of your question is, how do they keep you? That's what we call churn in the industry. How do we keep you from churning off? So one of the things people are always saying and debating in the industry is, okay, you got your Netflix account and you love two series and you binge watched all of them over the weekend. Do you keep your Netflix account next month or do you cancel it and churn off as a subscriber? Well, no right or wrong answer. Depends on what you're watching and how frequently you watch it. What we do see in the market is because these services don't require commitments from a contractual standpoint, there's a lot of people who will sign up for a service and stick with it for 3 months and then cancel it for two and then go back for a month and then cancel it. And then like, oh, my show that I really like came back. I'm going to get it again. And that's one of the great things for us for consumers is because we can jump between these services. Even Hulu used to put out publicly every once in a while how many subscribers they had just for their live version of Hulu. Mm-hmm. But then they stopped putting it out, and the reason they said was because people were turning it on and off so often. So a great example would be people would have Hulu on demand, but then come March Madness, they would add the live component for a month, right? And then March Madness is over, and they cancel the live component. Very smart. So Churn and retention is something that we want to know more about as an industry. Unfortunately, most of these companies, including even the public ones, provide very little details in the way of churn and retention and what the average is and how it goes up or down across the year. So we don't have a lot of data. A lot of this data by these companies, they never share externally ever, which makes my job as an analyst obviously much harder. But that's just the nature of the business. They consider that proprietary info.
When we think about streaming, let's also put it in the context of all the additional choices that we now have. I mean, I have not really explored. I use YouTube more as an instructional channel for different things that I might want to go up and learn about. And I'll go up and I'll play along to various music videos, whatever. But there are all these channels on YouTube. Then there are these, as you say, package services that now also do original programming like Hulu. You've got all of these. I mean, where do they all fit into this ecosystem?
Well, they're all different. So it goes back to our earlier conversation of just a lot of choice in the market. So with a lot of choice, what do you want to watch? YouTube has struggled, or really since Google bought them, it's been over 10 years now, YouTube has struggled to really define who are they and what do they want to be in the market. It used to be that it was just free content and it was ad supported. Then they had models where it was, you could sign up to certain channels for 99 cents a month. Then it was, okay, we're going to add live. Like, they've never figured out their strategy.
Well, now they'll ask you, do you want all the commercials up front or do you want them to interrupt the content?
Yes. So that's a different type of ad strategy they're taking in terms of what we really classify as ad formats. Pre-roll, post-roll, in streaming page. Sometimes you can select your commercial. YouTube has a bigger problem, which is they're not running it as a business. They're running it as a charity. Anybody can upload any video to YouTube at any time free of charge. Okay, that's very nice of you, but if you want to be thought of as a destination for premium content, you can't have 75% of your content that nobody wants to watch and no advertiser wants to support because it's not considered quality content. And that's a big problem that they have.
Where does this shakeout cruise go? I mean, we've got a lot of new services coming online, as you say, with very powerful and different types of companies backing it. I mean, I thought Amazon, for example, is an amazing thing. You think about it, you're signing up for free shipping, and along with that, you get a music service, you get this television service, which is pretty darn good. And with Mrs. Maisel and so many of these others, they've really built a niche there, too. And yet, we know what their major service is. We see it at our doorstep every day. I mean, what kind of shakedown cruise are we on?
Well, it's to be seen. So, again, the business models are different. You know, Amazon has a different reason for including video with Prime, and that's because they want you to buy more physical products that they ship to you, which is where they make more money. You know, that's where their margins are. So I like the approach. It's what we consider content bundling in the industry, which is you sign up for a service and you get a lot of different value from that. I think Amazon Prime is one of the best values out there because, to your point, it comes with music, video, free shipping of items. I think that's a great use of my personal dollars every month. Others might disagree because they don't buy a lot of product online or they're not interested in the music side. So it's not a one-size-fits-all answer. And that's something that's always going to be the case moving forward. I always use my mom as someone like an example. She doesn't watch any of the traditional content that's out there right now, but she loves British documentaries and anything British, even though she's not British. But so she loves Acorn TV. Right? Acorn TV is a great example of a service that is very niche, super targeted. They have a couple million paying subscribers a month, and there's nothing wrong with that. They can make money doing that and become profitable, because their customer acquisition costs are much lower because they know who they're targeting. They're never going to be 100 million subscribers, but they're not trying to be. So one of the problems in my industry is the media and others, they write about these services and they compare them one to the other, and they say, oh, look, this service has 100 million subs and this one only has 10 million, so the one with 10 million is doing poorly. No, they're not. They're doing great. They're just targeting a different audience.
When we do look at the metrics that are used to really analyze this, and that's what you're in the business of doing, I mean, can you trust it? I mean, I know in the past with television, it got a lot harder over time because people were recording things and playing it back. Now with these streaming services, I don't even know who is the legitimate source of information about the audience. And with some of these services giving you the option of having it with or without commercials, so you'll spend $4.99 a month, but you'll have commercials, or $7.99 without. I mean, how much more important is it going to be for these services to be able to really justify the metrics that they're providing to analysts like you?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really, really good question. The answer is there's very little data and metrics out there. So you have guys like Nielsen and others that are just doing total time watch, total hours spent, but those are not business metrics. So one of the biggest problems right now we have internally in our industry is that the data that is given out is inconsistent, incomplete, and has no business methodology behind it. So over the past month, because of what's been going with the virus, you have so many services coming out and saying, traffic last quarter, or really views, you know, total views or hours viewing on our service was up 56% compared to 3 weeks ago. And I contact the company when they send you that press release and I say, 56% compared to what? And they go, from 3 weeks ago. And I say, well, what was it 3 weeks ago? Well, we can't give you that information. Okay, but if I have one viewer and next month I have two, my percentage is 100%, right? That's great. So the issue is we can't trust most of the data in the market because most of the data is simply high level that doesn't have any business metrics around it. If you grew your traffic or your views 50% and you're ad supported, does that mean you also doubled the amount of ads you delivered? No, not necessarily. So you raise a great question, and the problem is we have very little data because these companies don't want to share it. So the data that we do have, you know, every other day someone's putting out some report going, did you know that video usage is growing by X percent? Yeah, thanks. We don't need to know that. Is there anybody in the world that doesn't know people are consuming more video? Right? That's not a business metric. But the metrics we really need, they're just not being shared.
From a programming standpoint, of course, started off with other people's libraries. Now, they still say Netflix has other people's libraries and they're still buying reruns of Seinfeld or whatever it may be. However, it's their original content. Then you go from original content that really is television-based, if you will, say Ozark, as I mentioned, or I Love Bloodline, or so many of the others. Having said that, now they're getting into theatrical releases, and The Irishman comes out about 2 months after it's in theaters. Now, you say to yourself, well, nobody's going out to theaters. Are we going to start seeing original screenplay, theatrical releases on streaming? Where is the programming content moving?
Well, that really depends on the service. And, you know, right now what my industry is sort of talking about is, you know, look what NBCU did. NBC Universal, because of this virus, said, okay, we're going to make 4 movies that are out in the theaters or coming out in the theaters, also available in digital, where you'll have to pay $25 to watch them. And people were going, oh my God, this is huge. Disney's going to follow suit, right? They're going to put Black Widow and everything online. And like, guys, no, they're not. Just relax, okay? If they have to wait even a year for James Bond or whatever to come to the theaters, they're going to make over $1 billion per movie. Well, that's what they're going to gross. So they're not going to stick it online just to stick it online, right? That they can't make up the same amount of money that way. So for the 4 movies NBC Universal picked, Trolls, really? I mean, is there a huge demand to watch Trolls, right? There's some, but my industry just needs to relax. The idea that now everything is going to go online is not the case. But to your point, it's a great question you ask. The dynamics of content creation and distribution have changed, and they continue to change. And for certain pieces of content, we're seeing it go direct to streaming services. Or we're seeing where, and this is interesting, it originally went to TV. It didn't do very well. It didn't get picked up for a second season, but it then got picked up for a second season on a streaming service. And the reason for that was that streaming service feels like it can create more awareness online and make that series popular more so than they could on traditional TV distribution.
Yeah, I found one that way. What about the binge watching motif? I mean, how, well, now, of course, there are probably a lot of people, kind of lying in bed just watching. But, I mean, how important is that? I know when they started saying to me, next episode, and all of a sudden it just ran over to that, away from the credits, which in a business that is so ego-driven, where we have to congratulate ourselves every 10 seconds, that's a big departure to dispense with the credits and get on to the next episode.
It is, but that's something that they have felt that all these services have all the data behind it that says, okay, we want to do, you know, start the next one playing. They have the data and analytics to show if we start it within a certain period of time, recommend this or that, it makes them consume X amount of more content on our service. So that's all pre-scripted, behind the scenes in terms of the data they have to know how to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, for those of us who like HBO and Showtime, I mean, now we get a little disappointed that, we have to wait another week to see the next episode. We've gotten, so spoiled by the way that these services allow us to watch everything in one gulp if we want. It's pretty remarkable the way they change expectations and viewing habits. In closing, though, I want to ask you about foreign distribution. About Netflix, for example, I keep seeing these titles that come up. They look interesting, and then I can tell they're obviously from a foreign source. They're subtitled. I mean, is that a big part of their business model, the foreign market? And how much more are we going to see that content coming from Mexico or Spain or Ireland or wherever it may be?
Yeah, it's definitely a big part. So Netflix has publicly stated, been very clear that the biggest growth for their service moving forward is outside the U.S. It's international. They also make more money from a margin standpoint on foreign subscribers than they do U.S. So that's where we've seen the biggest growth coming from. They have so many households in the U.S. that already have Netflix and have for some time that the growth there has slowed, and that's been that way for the years. They can still add new users, but just not at the rate they can going international. Now, when they go international, to your point, they have to have localized content. They have to have content in that region specific to what people want to watch. Many times it has to be in a different language. They might have to have subtitles. At the same time, they're also looking at, okay, what type of content is in the U.S. that people might want to watch outside the U.S. or vice versa? So that's a matter of knowing who your audience is and knowing what they want to watch. And as much as Netflix knows, and Amazon knows, and Hulu knows, it's still a guessing game. Because every year, you will see Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and everybody else that's creating original content announce that, well, there's a couple shows we're not bringing back. And why aren't they bringing them back? Because they just didn't do as successful as they hoped for. So as much as all these services know overall what we want to watch, it's still hit or miss at times in terms of new shows that they're creating.
Oh, absolutely. As someone who was in the programming game, I mean, that's always the case. And I'm also reading where they're really not looking at building that 100-episode library. If they get four seasons with 10 episodes out of Ozark, they're thrilled. And they won't make the determination sometimes as to the fourth season until they see how the third season is streaming.
Correct. Yep. They're using the data internally to figure out, okay, is this really a popular show? Should we carry another series?
Well, I've got to thank you. Dan Rayburn, we've been all over the map here talking about streaming services, and who better to go all over the map with than you? He's a streaming media expert, consultant, and he's also a principal analyst for Frost and Sullivan. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thanks for having me. This is great. If anyone has any follow-up questions, too, I'm happy to answer them. They can just go to danrayburn.com. You can see my email, my phone number. I'm always available.
All right, great. Thanks, Dan. And again, keep streaming.
Thank you.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.